thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Dave. I am a recovering drug addict, alcoholic, and codependent. And if you stick around long enough, your laundry list will also grow. That's the great thing about recovery. I'm honored to be here tonight. I love Cocaine Anonymous. It was one of my, well, I owe everything to cocaine, because if it hadn't been for cocaine, I never would have made it to the program when I did. And I always said that it was the greatest thing that ever happened to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it made people reach their bottom so much faster. And so I'd like to just start off telling you a little bit about how I got into the world, basically. You know, I never felt like, as a small kid, that I really fit in. I was always kind of the square peg in the round hole. Kind of chubby and thick glasses, and, you know, just, I wasn't one of the cool guys. And I was kind of a late bloomer. I really didn't start doing drugs and alcohol until I was about 11 or 12 years old. But I did at least start sniffing gasoline when I was 3. And so I knew what getting high felt like, and I knew I liked it. I got taken to the emergency room when I was 3 years old because I told my mother there was purple dragons floating in the toilet, and I was tripping. And so they thought I was drinking it, but I was really just huffing. And, you know, I didn't do that again for quite a while, but as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, I was told to go out and cut the lawn and that type of thing, and I'd go out there and stick my nose in the gas tank and just do it till I passed out. That's what I did. So I really believe I owe my life to drugs and alcohol, because I think I would have died as a teenager of a huffer. So that's why I don't have both oars in the water to start with. I've got to tell you that the first time I drank, I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I took one of these empty Pepsi bottles and took a little bit of, my dad had a liquor cabinet. You know, I came from a middle class home. My mother was a schizophrenic and my father was an adult child. So it was normal, you know what I mean? But the first time I really wanted to drink, we called it jungle juice. We just take an inch out of each of the bottles in the liquor cabinet and fill up the 16 ounce Pepsi bottle and chug it down. And then I tried doing it again, and I didn't quite get it down all the way, the second bottle. But I do remember running around the block in my underwear, and, you know, the next morning, we used to have unwed mothers come and live at our home so that they could take care of my younger sisters, because my mother wasn't really capable of doing that at that point. And first of all, I woke up in my bed in a pool of vomit. And I woke up and I said, wow, what the hell happened last night? And so I went downstairs, and this little gal, Debbie, this unwed mother who had helped my family with my younger sisters, she says, well, I'm quitting. And I said, well, what's going on? And she says, well, you told me I was a pregnant whore and to get the hell out of your house. And I said, well, and that's what alcohol does for me, okay? That's what it turns me into, just a raving lunatic asshole. And, you know, some people will tell you even without alcohol I can be a raving lunatic asshole, but the thing is, it's just magnified to the max. So that was my start of my drinking career. Marijuana was prevalent, LSD. I loved drinking with enhancements, Quaaludes, downers. I totaled out 3 of my father's cars before I was 16 years old, before I had a driver's license. My father and mother got a divorce. I helped in that so that I could turn the family home into a drug house and a party house. And my dad was an attorney. And the police really didn't want to come and raid that house, but if they had, you know, they're people passed out on the front lawn and that type of thing, in West Dallas. And it was not, a real conducive situation for raising my younger sisters or my younger brother, but I was the oldest, and I used to try to bring home girls that could help take care of my sisters and things like that. I loved any type of drug was okay with me. I didn't really have a preference. I started the day smoking pot out of my bong, and that became enshrined in the West Dallas Police Department when they did raid the house. And, you know, I was pretty much a small-time, just a petty, you know, drug-selling kid in high school. You know, sold little pot, little speed, little downers, that type of thing. And nothing really tremendous until the police came. My mother did have the wherewithal at one point to called them and tell them I was uncontrollable, and they came and picked me up and took me to jail, and that was my senior year of high school, and I had dropped out my senior year, but I did go back and I finished. Hey, is it okay if I drink some of this water? I don't know whose this is, but I need that. Who spit in that? Anyway, as I was being taken away, it was right after we had some fun things going on with my high school. We'd like to go in there and, you know, take things, triple beam scales, and just things that we could use for our activities. And so when the police came, they thought they had made this big bust because they found a triple beam scale, and there was no serial numbers on it or anything, but they tried to tell me that I was the one that was, you know, stealing all this stuff out of our high school, and they couldn't bust me because I didn't have any serial numbers on it. But I did go to jail, and I was in juvenile detention thing for a couple of months. And my father came along and said, "Dave, I don't expect you to change your stripes completely, but I will take you out of here if you promise to go back to high school." And I said, "Okay, Dad, I'll do that." By this time, my mother and father were divorced, and I consequently got him evicted from two apartments because, you know, every time he left, I'd start having people over, and, you know, people came over to buy things. Speed was big back then, White Cross and that type of thing. That's the kind of thing I did in high school. So I got him evicted out of a couple of apartments. And the thing was, I pretty much really hated my dad. Was disgusted with my mother. Didn't really care about anybody or anything as long as I could get my next high. And that was pretty much it. And I don't know if I was born missing something or what the deal was, but I knew I just wasn't quite right. And so bottom line is, my father got sick of me getting him evicted and that type of thing. And I did graduate from high school, which was a miracle, you know. They let me come back after dropping out a half a year. I think they kind of just pushed me out of there to get me out of there because I was 17 when I graduated, and you know, I told them, I threatened to come back if they didn't let me graduate. So they let me graduate. So at that point, I graduated. I'd been on a couple of road trips and ended up in jail in certain places like San Francisco, and the police walking me to the plane telling me not to come back there. And so obviously I had to come back there and live sometime in my young adulthood, because that's the kind of guy I was. You know, if you told me not to do it, that's what I was going to do. And so anyway, once I graduated from high school, I met a guy, and you know, I had a lot of different people I bought drugs from, And I met this one fella, and he and I kind of hooked up, and all of a sudden I became my connection's connection. You know, I was lots of marijuana and that type of thing, and that was when things started getting kind of serious. You know, I was making a living selling drugs, and that was my, you know, I lived to use and used to live. Everything in my life was all about drugs. And as I was, you know, moving up the chain, I call it, the food chain in the drug world, you know, a lot of nasty things were happening. But I always tried to, I never wanted to be the kind of guy that wouldn't do the drugs I was selling. That didn't make sense to me. So I was a good old party boy, you know. When the marijuana, the Colombian red bud dried up, we moved to cocaine, and that was a whole nother level, you know. White powder. I remember the first time I shot up cocaine, I was an IV drug user from the time I was about 18 years old. I broke up with some gal, you know, girlfriend, and I always figured, you know, sniffing this stuff just is, what's the point, you know, what's the point? So I broke up with some gal and used that as an excuse to start shooting dope. And I loved it. I purely fell in love with cocaine. It was my drug of choice at that point. And the nice thing was, I was really lucky because I had enough cocaine to kill myself. And I found out that even having enough to OD and kill yourself is not enough. And I said, wow, this is bad. You know, my heart stopped, I'm having out-of-body experiences, my veins are collapsed, my nose is sideways. And I said, you know, this isn't right, I still want more. I want it till I'm dead, you know. It wasn't good. If you mix it with a little heroin, it helped, you know. So the bottom line is, you know, I got involved in some heavy stuff in the area. People were blowing each other in half and freaking drug wars in the late 70s and just a lot of shit going down. And it just so happened that, you know, there's so much more of that, but the bottom line is I was court-ordered into treatment in 1982, and that was either, I was given the choice. I either go to jail for a year or I go to DePaul Hospital and talk to them about, recovery. So obviously I went with, you know, going to treatment, and I did my 30 days in the House of Correction. I went to my first AA meeting in the House of Correction, and, you know, I didn't want any part of it. I really didn't. When they told me that, you know, just to even think of living without doing drugs or alcohol was like, it was like they were talking a foreign language to me. I couldn't even comprehend it. When I went through treatment, I got pretty involved in NA, you know, because NA was, you know, there at DePaul Hospital, and I went to a few AA meetings, and I actually, you know, when I went into treatment, I remember I was waiting to be called in for treatment, and that day I woke up, and I had had a bad night that night. I was staying at my family home, and something happened. I got into a fight with my girlfriend, and she scraped my face, and I hurt my father, put him up against the wall, kicked my dog, threw my parrot across the room. I was in a lot of pain. You know, I was in a lot of pain. And when I woke up that morning, like I had so many times, I stuck the gun in my mouth and said, this is it, I'm gonna pull the trigger. And as I did that, I got a call from DePaul saying, you've got your bed ready. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should just hold off on this, blowing my brains out and check this out. So that's what I did. You know, I went to DePaul, and I was there, you know. It's like, you do whatever you have to do to get the hell out of there, you know what I mean? But I wanted to prove to myself that I was not a drug addict or an alcoholic, you know? I mean, I wanted to make sure I wasn't. So I actually went to a lot of meetings, and I met a lot of really neat people. One of them was a big CA member, Kenny DeFord. He's passed away not too long ago. But, you know, I met a lot of people and a lot of love. And there was some time there that I actually started to be okay with myself and not wanting to die, you know. Because for many years, I really didn't give a shit if I died. In fact, I'd asked many police to pull the trigger, and they just didn't have the balls to do it, or they just laughed at me or wanted me to suffer, you know? Because I felt life was all about suffering, and you just live through it. And, you know, when I came here, I did believe in God. But the thing is, I hated him. And if I thought God wanted me to do one thing, I'd do the opposite, because I just, you know, I was pissed. I was mad as hell, you know, and that's how I grew up. And I think maybe all that huffing as a kid did something to me too. And I came to a point where I found a God that I wasn't mad at. So that was good. And I was clean in 1982 until early 1983. So I went into treatment in October, and the seeds were planted. And there were some wonderful people in my group. In fact, this morning I was opening up my old big book from DePaul Hospital, and, you know, it kind of brought a tear to my eye, because, you know, it's like a yearbook or something. People say, hey, thanks for being here, and you're special, and keep your eyes to the sky, and blah, blah. You know what I mean? All this neat stuff, you know? And for somebody that's like a homicidal fucking killer, you know, just like ready to, you know, shoot people and chop off hands and collect money, it's just like, you know, it just melted me. It melted me. So anyway, I stayed clean. I wanted to prove to myself I really wasn't a real drug addict or alcoholic. And I stayed clean for 3 or 4 months, and then decided that, you know, I could maybe smoke a little pot. And once I smoked a little pot, I just felt, I mean, I got pretty damn high. And I felt like, well, you know what? I really need a couple of drinks to bring me down a little bit. And after that, it was just back to the races. So bottom line is, my sobriety lasted about 4 months. And I'm grateful for that sobriety, very grateful, because I knew where to come back to. And that's home. And see, when I'm here, I'm at home. I'm at home. You're my family. You're the people that keep me here. God works through you. And God works through me too. You know, but we're all struggling to live life on life's terms without drugs and alcohol. And that's what it's all about. And the only way I know how to do that is with a loving God. And I'll tell you a little bit about my relapse after experiencing a few months of recovery and deciding I really wasn't a drug addict or an alcoholic. Got into a fight with my girlfriend, as usual. I was talking to her on the phone in a bar, and somebody came up to me, some big guy, I don't know, a biker type. Didn't know he was the son-in-law of the bar owner, but he wanted to use the phone, and he hung the phone up on me. And I just took a beer mug and started bludgeoning him, and he went into a coma. And everybody saw this, blood everywhere. They said, Dave, you better get out of here. So I was then on the run for putting this guy in a coma. So I decided that I was going to go visit this girl who left the country every winter to go live in the Cayman Islands. So I said, well, that's where I'm going. I'm going down to the Cayman Islands. So I went down there, and she was hooked up with some millionaire. So I ended up hooking up with some gal that was a native there. And she was a fun gal, and we ended up getting married, you know. Go figure. It was either get married or go back home. It was like one of those deals. They let me stay there if I was married. So we got married, and I ran a couple of jewelry shops down there, and I was just grateful that I was there. It was nice, you know. I met a lot of interesting people, Muhammad Ali, Ringo Starr, a few other people that would come down, you know, the celebrity types and all that. And it was kind of like living the dream. And what I was trying to do was live the program without the first step. I thought, if I just work the 11 steps and maybe just try and control this drinking thing. I wasn't doing any more IV drug use. I might snort a little coke. I might drink a little rum punch or whatever. But I wasn't going to go full bore. Of course, I was smoking lots of ganja. Lots of ganja was it. Anyway, my wife and I got into a little disagreement. She came at me with a machete, and I kicked her in the face. And there I was sitting in the jail cell. And her mother was really into voodoo, and she put a voodoo curse on me. And, you know, I mean, that sounds funny, but at the time it was pretty serious stuff, you know what I mean? She's like cutting goats' throats and stuff, and I'm like, okay, whatever. So anyway, they let me out of jail, and I said, well, that's it, I'm going to Jamaica. And so I went to Jamaica. Pretty much, I was on some kind of suicidal death binge at this point. I just wanted to really freaking do it. So what I did in Jamaica was I hooked up with one of my friends. He was a cab driver, and he took me around, and he kept me alive. And I'd go to places that white men weren't supposed to go, you know what I mean? And that was just where I'd go. I loved Jamaica. I lived in Kingston, and I took the tour around the island, and I just stayed drunk. I read the whole Bible. I didn't know how long I was going to stay there, but I know when I went out into the country and to buy some ganja, and they gave me a grocery bag full of some real nice Jamaican bud, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to be here for a while. And that's where I stayed. But I was with a different woman every night. I was drunk every night. I stayed away from the cocaine at that point, but I was just pretty much on a suicidal death binge. So it didn't work out. I kept living, and finally I decided that it was time for me to come back to Wisconsin. And that was really depressing, because by this time, you know, I'd gotten all my legal fees or all my legal problems taken care of while I was there. I was there for about 3 years. And so I called my father and said, Dad, I think I'm going to be coming home. And I found this out later that my sisters told me that he turned white as a ghost and started sweating and shaking because he really, really, really did not want me to come back. And because I don't blame him, you know, I don't blame him. But he said that if I really had to, you know, he'd let me stay at his place for a few nights, that type of deal. So I said, well, I'm coming home, so get ready. And at this point, when I did make it home, I remember flying over Chicago, looking at the dirty snow. It was March, and it was 1985, March. And I'm looking at the dirty snow going, I wish I could just jump out of this fucking plane right now. I don't want to go back. I don't really want to go back, but I wasn't dying. And so when I got home, I told my father that I was going to try getting into this recovery thing again. Because by this time, you know, Again, I was suicidal. Oh, poor Dave. Another relationship didn't work out. Oh, you know, let's feel the pain. I think I got addicted to emotional pain, you know? And that way, when I acted out, it seemed appropriate, you know? When I was in pain, I wanted everybody to hurt, you know? It just seemed appropriate. So the bottom line is the self-hatred and the shame and the guilt were driving me. And when I came back, my business partner, who I still love to this day, you know, he's like a brother to me. He was being sent to prison for 7 years, federal time. And he asked me, he says, Dave, you know, this half of the system is fucked up, but this half is still good. And if you want, you know, you can just run the show here. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to try this recovery thing again because, you know, that just doesn't seem like the way I want to go. And that was a decision I made. I made that decision to do something, but I had no idea what the hell I was really going to do because the only thing I'd really ever done is sell drugs. And, you know, there was a short, fun time when I was selling cookware to single working girls and let my sexual addiction take over, that type of thing, running around the country and, you know, selling cookware to single working girls. And the funny thing is, where I was trained to do that was in the CA Central office there on 92nd and Blue Mound. So when I found out that's for central offices, I went, wow, this is a blast to the past. And I could tell you long stories about that short little 5 month little excursion. And it's not pretty. But the bottom line is, you know, when I did come back, I was ripe. And I went back to DePaul Hospital and I told them, I said, listen, if you don't let me in, I'm gonna kill myself, blah, 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 blah. And they said, well, you can come to outpatient. And I said, okay. And so I was pretty serious about wanting to change at that point. I made a decision I wasn't going to sell drugs anymore, and I was scared. I didn't know what I was going to do if I couldn't self-medicate myself. But I knew that time, that short period of time where I was clean back in 1982, I wasn't suicidal. I just wanted to not be suicidal. You know, that's all I wanted. I wasn't asking for happiness or any of that stuff. I just wanted to stop the self-hatred and loathing. And so at that point is when my real recovery started. And the doors opened. You know, I went to outpatient. I did have a couple of relapses during outpatient, and I don't even want to get into it. Had to do with shooting cocaine, you know, because the bottom line is, if I figured it like this. I haven't shot any dope for a long time, and if I'm going to stay clean from now on, I better do what I love, you know, and that's just how my brain works. So I went out and got some coke, and the gal I was with, she wanted to do the last shot, and I threatened to kill her, and it was, yeah, anyway, I got the last shot, and it wasn't enough, just so you know, it wasn't ever near enough. So after those little relapses there, I found a group of my NA buddies were going to a retreat in Michigan, and it was called an Agape retreat. And I said, well, what's this? And this guy's like, Dave, you don't want to go. You don't want to go. I said, why wouldn't I want to go? And then this guy, my other buddy says, yeah, Dave, you do want to go. He's just afraid you're going to get all the girls there. And I'm like, oh, I don't. So anyway, you know, I was a dog. So I went to this Agape retreat, and something happened to me. It was started by young people in AA back in 72 or so. I'll tell you what, it was like what I considered a hippie love-in thing. You know what I mean? Everybody's laying on the floor, giving each other massages, and they're talking about auras and the third eye and all that, and I'm like, wow, this is kind of cool. You know, this isn't like sitting around the tables listening to some old guy, you know, how he's not going to take a drink today. And I thought, well, I liked this, but I was in enough emotional pain where something happened. I didn't sleep that whole weekend, and something happened during the God meeting, and I actually had a spiritual experience, and it was what I consider my burning bush. You know, somebody said something, and I just pretty much hit the floor, pretty much like convulsing, crying, and people jumping on me saying, leave the pain here, you don't have to take it home. And I thought I was having a hallucination, because I was seeing darkness, and then I was seeing light, and I was like, you know, just letting a lifetime full of self-hatred and pain out in a period of 20 minutes. And that was my little spiritual experience, and maybe an awakening, because from that time on, you know, that was back in April 22nd of 1985, I haven't found it necessary to go back to drugs and alcohol. So that was a great time. But that has nothing to do with me, because that's all about you. It's all about you guys, because my God works through you guys. And, you know, I met a lot of neat people, and they told me, just suit up and show up. Remember, your brain is going to kill you. Your brain wants you dead. Your addiction is patient, and it's gonna wait for you when you're at that weak point. And let me tell you, life gives us many weak points. You know, as I've gone through life, you know, in recovery, I've had some wonderful experiences, and I've had some devastating experiences. And the trick is to just not pick up. And, you know, when shit hits the fan and your whole life is going out the window, just know that if you don't pick up, there's still hope. There's still hope. You know, they can take away my job, they can take away my home, they can take away my money, and they did. All that stuff when I was 10 years sober, got my first divorce in recovery, and it devastated me. My friends came and took my guns away, said, you don't need these, Dave. I checked myself into charter for a couple of days because I couldn't eat or sleep, but I didn't pick up. You know, I didn't pick up, because I knew that if I picked up, I wasn't coming back. And I like it here. I like it here. This is the softer, easier way. Working the 12 steps, it might seem like, oh my God, but you know what? It's really no big thing. If we humble ourselves enough to really do just make a half-hearted attempt to work the steps, don't worry. You'll be working them again if you stick around, because there's going to come a time when you're going to say, hey, you know what? I'm in a lot of pain. I think I might need to do another fourth step, you know? I might need to do another fifth step. Where's my sponsor? It took me 5 years to get a sponsor, but I'll tell you what I believe the most important things in recovery are: to keep suiting up and showing up no matter what, you know? Go to your meetings, because the meetings are what, you know, it gives us something to do. It gives us a place to be. And get a home group, because if you get a home group, you've committed. And if you commit, you need to commit to this. It's not like, maybe I'll hit a meeting here, and, you know, it can't really be half-hearted, because you've got to want this more than anything in the world. And I'll tell you what, the love I have for myself today and other people, and, you know, when they say you don't want to close the door on the past, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm embarrassed about, and that I feel bad about in my past. But the thing is, you know, recovery has given me the opportunity to forgive myself and learn how to love myself. Let go of the toxic shame and guilt and remorse, and, you know, it's a beautiful way of life. No matter what happens today, nothing justifies taking a drink or a drug for this alcoholic and drug addict. I'm still working on that codependency issue. You know, it's another layer of the onion. But, you know, relationships have always been a tough one for me, because I am a self-centered asshole, you know, and I know that. But I'm better than I used to be, but I'm still not where I want to be. I've got a little boy, he's not so little anymore, he's 16 years old, and he's never seen me drunk, and he's never seen me high. He's a little recovery kid. Some of you may remember him. His name's Dave, too. And I'm so proud of him because, you know, he went through with me, hand in hand, through a tough divorce the last few years, and, you know, he's pretty much got his head on his shoulders straight, and I'm grateful for that. He's nothing like I was, and, you know, he just texted me today. I asked him if he wanted to come. He says, "No, Dad, I really don't want to." He says, "I'd just soon remember you this way." I said, "Okay, no problem." But, you know, all the gifts I have today are due to the program. And really, you know, the 12 steps are the answer. Like I said, I believe that even if you just half-heartedly work those steps, you know, don't worry. They never stop. We just keep on doing them. You'll catch on. You know, you'll get deeper. You'll get deeper into the onion. More layers will be revealed. And as you do, you know, life gets more exciting. You see the miracles happen on a daily basis. I still start my day on my knees to remember to keep me right-sized, you know, to let God know that I'm just another bozo on the bus and I'm not telling him what to do, but to please take me by the hand, because my sponsor told me God's a perfect gentleman and he only comes where he's invited. And I invite him into my life every day because I need a loving God that loves me unconditionally in my life every day, because without that, I'm doomed, you know. It doesn't matter if I'm going to meetings. If my God is going to be that judgeful guy that I came in here with, I'm doomed. So I just hope that you guys can forgive yourselves for being who you are and who you've been, because that's what recovery is all about, forgiving ourselves and learning how to love each other. And don't be afraid to get your butt to a meeting when things are good, and don't worry about coming when they're bad. And you know, when I found out my dad died, I was at Marching to the Steps. When I found out one of my best friends died, I came and hit the whatever and cried on Thomas's shoulder for a couple of minutes. You know what I mean? It's like, that's what meetings are for, you know? The tough guys learn how to cry, you know, because that's the deal, you know? We gotta cry, because otherwise we're gonna hurt ourselves in some way, and it won't be pretty. So with that, I'm gonna pass. I love you guys. Thanks for being here.